You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, we'll look at the problems of using body mass index as a standalone measure of health as the use of obesity drugs becomes more common. Now it's time for Wisconsin Life. Here's producer Tyler Ditter with a story about a Wisconsin couple falling in love.
Though Steve and Emily Lakatis met in their 30s, they both found out it's near impossible to escape the awkwardness of a first date. And though it didn't go as well as they hoped, the one who set them up had the feeling that sometimes you just need a second chance. The couple talked with one another about that experience as part of a StoryCorps mobile tour stop in Green Bay, Wisconsin.
Steve Lakatis, age 43.
And I'm Emily Lakatis. I'm 41. All right, well, you showed up and you just cleaned out your car. It looked very nice. And I looked at your eyes. You had a very long beard and very long hair at that time and a ponytail at the back of your neck. But you had very kind looking eyes. So I looked at you in the car because we had never met each other. You picked me up and that was the first time we met. And then you wanted to go to this Mexican restaurant in Hammond. What was it called again? That famous Mexican restaurant.
El Taco Real.
El Taco Real in Hammond, because you knew that from your childhood. So we went, and you had the worst stomach problems, and you wouldn't tell me what was wrong.
That's true. So I was like,
what is going on with this guy? And he was like, kept going to the bathroom, and he wouldn't tell me what was wrong. So it was kind of weird and bizarre. And to compensate, I just kept talking and talking and talking because you were just being so weird. And so you thought you were not impressed because you thought I was just this crazy chatterbox. And I was not impressed because I was like, what is with this guy? So actually, we didn't really go on a second date for quite a long time. But then I was at the clinic. The clinic where you worked was my vet clinic for the rescue I ran, Happy Tales. And so I was there at the clinic, and just you happened to be bringing out some kittens to come to the front desk as I was there bringing an animal. And you kind of looked at me, and you were like, oh, hi. And I still to this day don't know if you came out there on purpose or if Mickey or somebody sent you out there. But when they saw that I was there.
I think Mickey sent me.
I think Mickey sent you. Okay, that's the first time you've ever admitted that.
She tricked me. I didn't know you were out there. She said she needed me to bring something up there, and then I ran into you.
Yeah. Wow, she is good.
Yeah.
So she was the one, Mickey, who set us up the first time, and then she created this second. Anyway, you kind of looked at me and you were like, oh, yeah, hey, like, I remember you. And you said something, oh, I'll give you a call or something like that. And you actually did, like, you started texting me again, which I was kind of shocked about. And I remember telling Mickey after our first date, I was like, Mickey, I wasn't impressed.
Yeah, I believe that.
And but then I don't know why we gave you a shot. So was the second date, was that the Gary Railcats game?
I think it was, yeah.
Okay. Anyway, we went to the Gary Railcats game and we started talking and we were just having so much fun. We had good conversation. We both think we're quite clever, I think, is what it comes down to. And funny. So we went to the Railcats game and we kind of hit it off. And then we officially, I think, started kind of dating.
So we married on June 16th of 2020. We're parents of two, one of which our daughter was just born about 4 weeks ago at this point.
We can't believe all the twists and turns that have led us to come to this place with these children. It's miraculous, and I think we're both just in awe of it and really grateful.
And, you know, I love you more all the time.
I love you.
Thanks, I love you,
Steve.
Too, Emily.
That was Steve and Emily Lakatis of Green Bay. Their interviews were recorded at StoryCorps, a national initiative to record and collect stories of everyday people. Excerpts were selected and produced by Wisconsin Public Radio. Wisconsin Life is a co-production of WPR and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. I'm Tyler Ditter.
Now, body mass index, a measure of someone's weight to height ratio, has come under fire as an inaccurate measure of someone's overall health, a especially if it's not used in conjunction with other factors like body fat percentage and more. Over the summer, the American Medical Association said that BMI should not be used as a standalone measure of health, saying the medical field has an over-reliance on BMI as a diagnostic tool. Now, with the rise of new obesity drugs, BMI is being used as a key part of the decision of whether to make that prescription. Our next guest dug into the story behind body mass index and medical care. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you ever received medical advice or treatment based on your body mass index, your BMI? Do you think your BMI is a reflection of your overall health profile, or does it seem a little bit off base? Should it be taken into account when we receive medical care of various sorts? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or email ideas@WPR.org. Yasmin Tayeg is a staff writer at The Atlantic. Yasmin, welcome to Central Time.
Hi, thank you so much for having me.
Now, BMI is kind of a household phrase nowadays. You dug into the history of it a lot. I didn't know about where this concept came from and how people intended and didn't intend for it to be used. Give us a little bit of the backstory behind body mass index.
Yeah, I mean, most of us know body mass index as, you know, at the very least, just as a sort of snapshot of our health. We have this idea that a high body mass index is bad and a low body mass index is good. But in reality, this thing came about like 200 years ago, and it was not meant to be used in that way at all. It started as something called the Quetelet Index, and it was named after this Belgian mathematician and astronomer who came up with a calculation to describe what he saw in data sets about European men. So this guy was looking at, you know, the heights and weights of average men and trying to come up with a way to, you know, quantify what a normal seeming weight was. And he came up with this equation. But the key here is that he was just trying to describe what he was already seeing. He was not trying to tell people what they should be aiming for. But over the years, that's how it came to be used. You know, at first, the insurance industry got its hands on this index and started creating these tables of weight and height to determine who was high risk and who was not. So they'd say, oh, you know, a person with X height and X weight would be considered high risk, and therefore, you know, we should factor that into our calculations for their insurance rates. Eventually, this concept of high risk versus low risk morphed into an ideal versus non-ideal weight. And eventually that transformed into what we conceive of as like an overweight or obese weight versus a normal weight. But there was a lot of transformation in there over the years where I think the true meaning of what this thing was supposed to be got totally lost.
What are some of the things that can throw off BMI as a measure? We have this ratio of weight to height, but there are a lot of factors, you write, that can say, well, wait a minute, this person at a lower BMI might be at a higher risk. This person at a higher BMI might be at a lower risk than we think just by looking at the numbers alone.
Absolutely. And, you know, like you said, the key thing to remember is that BMI only takes into account height and weight. But there are all sorts of other factors that go into somebody's health. So, you know, the reason I wanted to write the story is because my dad was talking to me about this. My dad is a very muscular person. He's like in his 60s, he plays a lot of basketball. And according to the BMI charts, he's overweight, but he maintains that he's quite healthy and just a muscular guy. And this is one of the issues that comes up. People who are very muscular tend to be heavier. For example, like LeBron James, and he would be considered overweight on the BMI scale when, you know, really you look at this guy, he's not unhealthy, right? But on the flip side, something that some of the doctors told me is that you could actually have a normal BMI and actually be obese. So another thing that BMI doesn't account for is where is how much fat is on your body and where that fat is on the body. And so that's important because the positioning, the distribution of the fat on the body has some implications for your health. So for example, the sort of soft fat on your sides that you can pinch with your fingers, the fat that lives under your skin, that's not considered quite as risky for your health as what is known as visceral fat, which is the fat that lives deep in between your organs and tissues, and it kind of feels hard in your abdomen. That is associated with heart disease and other ailments. But BMI doesn't capture any of that because it doesn't look at fat content or distribution at all, which is what makes it all the more crazy that BMI is used to define obesity, which is a disease about fatness and adiposity.
Now, here's a new wrinkle. People may have heard a lot about this new generation of obesity treatments, kind of descended from diabetes treatments, the Ozempics and Wegovys, and the list keeps getting longer. And one of the diagnostic tools on if I prescribe this to you but not you is BMI. How is this being used with this new class of weight loss drugs?
Absolutely. I mean, these weight loss drugs, well, I'll say that the experts I've spoken to have wanted to clarify their obesity drugs. And this is important because, they're meant to treat obesity, which is why their criteria for prescribing for prescription are based on our definitions of obesity. And so the CDC, the World Health Organization, they use BMI to define who is obese. A person who is with obesity has a BMI greater than or equal to 30. A person who is overweight has a BMI greater than or equal to 25. And so the prescription requirements for obesity drugs like Wegovy and now Zepbound are roughly based on this. So the rules are that you have to have a BMI of 30 and over, or a BMI of, I believe, 27 and over, with some sort of weight-related medical condition, like hypertension or diabetes, for example. It's kind of funny to think that there's such a high demand for these drugs. And at the end of the day, one of the biggest criteria determining whether or not you're going to get them is if you have the right BMI.
Let's bring on a caller at 800-642-1234. Bob is with us in Sparta. Bob, hi.
Hi.
What do you want to tell us about?
I was just telling your receptionist there, whoever answers the phone there, back in 78, 79, when the Army first came out with the height weight program, and they were throwing people out of the Army because they didn't meet the standards. And that's all they went by, was a straight up height weight. And I had a guy in my section, he was built like an upside down pyramid with the point on the bottom. And he was a wrestler, and a bodybuilder, weightlifter. The guy didn't have an ounce of fat on him, but they kept harassing the death out of him, telling him he had to lose the weight. There was absolutely nothing to lose. He finally got tired of a method, and he said, just put me out. And we lost a lot of good people back then when they first initially came out with that program.
Bob, interesting. Thanks for sharing that. Yasmin, a lot of decisions. The Army, it sounds like, some kinds of medical treatment. You mentioned insurance, even adoption. You give an example of one case. People are making a lot of big decisions about people based on that one number, the BMI.
Totally. It's become so baked into the way we think about health in this country, well, not just in this country, but worldwide. And I think that's why the American Medical Association and the rest of the health world decided this year that, okay, it's time to really rethink this because this is getting a little out of hand.
Bob, thanks a lot for sharing that story. We're talking to Yasmin Tayag, staff writer at The Atlantic. She's talking to us about body mass index, BMI, as obesity drugs rise in popularity. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Has BMI made it harder for you to get health care of one sort or another? Have your concerns at the doctor's office you feel like ever been dismissed because of your body mass index? Do you work in some profession that uses BMI as a key statistic one way or another? Join the conversation with your experiences, your thoughts, your questions at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or email ideas@WPR.org. We'll pick up the conversation coming up here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our talk with Yasmin Tayegh, staff writer at The Atlantic. She's talking to us about her recent reporting on the problems with using body mass index, BMI, as a standalone health measure. It's taken on new importance with a line of obesity drugs now on the market. You can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you tried to get a prescription for one of these new obesity drugs that's out there? Was BMI a factor in whether or not it was prescribed to you? Have you ever taken measures aimed at changing that number, BMI? Not just losing weight, but saying, hey, I want to get to a target body mass index. If you are in healthcare, how do you use that number? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Yasmin, you mentioned that advisory from the American Medical Association saying, hey, let's not put so much weight, if you will, on BMI in doctor's visits. What are they recommending to people? How are they looking to use BMI in conjunction with other factors?
Yeah, you know, that American Medical Association policy change was a long time coming. And, you know, they basically told doctors, you know, we really encourage you not to use BMI alone as a snapshot of someone's health. If anything, they want doctors to use it alongside other metrics that will tell you about a person's health. So, you know, like we mentioned before, you could measure their fat, you could look at their blood sugar levels, you could look at their high blood pressure, you know, all of these, you know, various data points that together would provide a far more complete picture of a person's health than only their height and weight. And I think part of the push here is to prevent doctors from falling into the trap of judging a patient by solely their BMI. You know, unfortunately, we see some reports of that happening where a patient will come in, you know, get their height and weight measured, and, you know, the provider will take a look at their BMI and think, oh, you're overweight, and then go on to dismiss a lot of that person's other medical concerns. And so, you know, I think there's a general push to encourage doctors to look very carefully at the whole picture rather than this just one thing.
Let's go back to our callers. Jenny is with us in Dane County. Jenny, hello.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What'd you want to tell us about?
Well, I just wanted to mention that when physicians use BMI for a Medicare wellness visit, that's a big indicator whether or not a person is high risk. So that can influence the reimbursement that medical facilities get, which I thought was an interesting point just to throw out there.
And it sounds like you work in a medical field, Jenny?
I do.
Yeah, and what do you think? I mean, do you feel like, okay, yeah, BMI is pretty good at valuing that risk, or do you think you wish there was a little more to it?
Well, there's a lot of factors that go into it, but BMI can be used to get higher reimbursement for Medicare annual wellness visits, which, you know, like you've been talking about, I don't think that BMI alone is a good indicator because there's so many other factors and it's all individual based. So I don't really care much for the BMI.
Gotcha. Jenny, thanks a lot for sharing that. I don't know, Yasmin, is there just something about, like, it's an easy statistic, it's one number that we could put on a scale as opposed to a lot of you know, qualitative observations? Is that part of why we've relied on BMI so much?
Absolutely. You know, doctors will tell you it's not completely useless. BMI is best used as like a screening tool. And so, you know, you look at a person and it sort of puts them into a broad bucket of whether they might be high risk or not. But the idea is that you're supposed to go further than that screening and then do other assessments. But doctors will tell you that the reason that BMI has stuck around is because it's A, really easy to measure. You just take the height and weight, and B, really cheap and fast. Mm. And as you know, we know doctors are increasingly short on time to spend with their patients.
And we just have time for one more quick caller. I want to jump in, Yasmin.
Sure.
Teresa is with us in Madison. Teresa, hi.
Hello.
What did you want to tell us about Teresa?
Well, it's kind of what you're just talking about right now. Sometimes it can be, BMI can be used to prevent, you know, certain medical procedures. And I mean, I need a kidney transplant and the transplant team won't even speak to me until I reach a certain BMI. Mm. So I have to lose weight before I can even be considered for a transplant.
Teresa, thanks. I'm so sorry to hear about that. Yasmin, in just our last half a minute, there's a lot at stake here, life or death in some cases, in how we use BMI.
Yeah, absolutely. There really is. But fortunately, there seems to be a push among doctors, people who are making these decisions, to consider more. And there's also an effort to define obesity in a more specific way using like different markers from organs from the body systems. And so hopefully we will not always have to rely on such a vague metric.
Yasmin, we'll leave it there. Thanks again for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
That's Yasmin Tayag, staff writer at The Atlantic. She talked to us about her recent reporting on the continued use of body mass index, or BMI, as a standalone health measure. The American Medical Association said this summer, doctors should stop relying on BMI so much. Coming up tomorrow on Central Time, the latest fusion research is raising hopes of commercial fusion power at an international climate conference, but is it really close to reality? A Wisconsin energy expert digs into the latest on the science of fusion. That and more coming up tomorrow here on Central Time. Coming up after the news, a social relationships expert and psychologist joins us to talk about friendships and, when they're not going well, how to fix them or end them. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. It's Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. How are your friendships doing? Earlier this fall, Pew Research Center released findings from a survey it did about Americans and their friendships. According to Pew, 61% of U.S. adults said having close friends is extremely important or very important for people to live a fulfilling life. That's more than 30% higher than the number of people who said being married or having kids or having lots of money was the key to fulfillment. But what happens when those friendships, even the close ones, start to run out of steam? Given that importance, it can be really hard to take a hard look at what we're getting and not getting from our friendly relationships. Our next guest has some suggestions to help. That includes making the call, in some cases, to break up with our friends. You could join in at 800-642-1234. How important are your friends in your life? How satisfied are you with your friendships? How often do you really reflect on your friendships, their value, whether they're healthy, and have you ever ended a friend relationship on purpose, or you just let it fizzle out? Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Todd Kashdan is professor of psychology at George Mason University in Northern Virginia and an expert on the psychology of well-being, psychological strengths, mental agility, and social relationships. His books include The Upside of Your Dark Side and The Art of Insubordination, How to Dissent and Defy Effectively. He recently wrote a newsletter post about breaking up with friends. Todd, welcome back to Central Time.
Hey, it's so good to be here.
You cover a lot of different social relationship topics in your work and on your newsletter. What led you to tackle our friendships this time around?
Well, one of the interesting things that happened during the pandemic was you had people trapped in their households and you saw this bifurcated response. People had realized how strong their romantic relationships, relationships with their kids and friendships are. And other people realized they aren't as strong as intimate as they thought. And they felt lonely, even though they had people with them trapped in their house for years.
And how did that end up affecting the importance we place on friends?
I think it made people realize, one, fitting with the science, that there is no greater predictor of who ends up very happy versus just being happy than the quality and significance of our relationships. But in over the past few years, I think people realize that I'm investing a ton in my romance life, and I'm investing a ton if I have kids, but very little rituals exist in society other than this thing called Friendsgiving for what we do with our friends.
Yeah, I think a lot of us might think, you know, friendships just happen naturally. They emerge out of whatever proximity, shared interest, and they rise or fall on their own power. Is it worth thinking about them as something we might have to do some work on, just like we might work on a marriage or other romantic relationship?
Absolutely. And that's why I'm glad we're having this conversation, because if we really dissect what are the things that we get from friends that are a little bit timeless compared to other relationships, and you can break it down into six. So one is, good friends are there when you need support. The other is when you need help, like you don't know how to break open a lawnmower when it's broken or fix a flat tire. The other is loyalty, is that they're going to stand for you even when you're not there and protect your reputation. Then there's a sense of trust. You can confide in them. Don't forget, you just have these joyful, pleasant, funny, wacky, bizarre experiences. And finally, someone to share in not just the bad things that happen in your life, but share your successes without feeling envious or jealous. And that's six really juicy things to have in your life.
You talk about kind of an experiment of doing friendship audits, taking these relationships that we might take for granted and thinking about what kind of value we get from them, which could lead us to appreciate them all the more or to figure out if we need to fix or end things. How do we get started on that process? We think of this friendship in a way we haven't thought of it before.
Yeah, so I just made a cute little survey based on the scientific research. And one of the things you could ask yourself is, after you spend time with them, is your energy going up, going down, or staying the same regularly? And so you can make this is a really good indicator of the quality of being with the person. If you play pickleball or basketball or chess, like, do you find yourself annoyed and disturbed after interacting with them? Because that's usually a sign that this is not someone that is fitting well into your life, unless they have some super specialized skill or strength that they're giving you. Another one is, to what degree, after you share something important to them, do you feel heard and validated? Are they your cheerleader, or do they treat you like an inanimate object, like those cheese balls that we always pass in Costco, but you never really want to be buying them? And then another one is, how do you resolve conflicts in your friendship? And if you're not having any conflicts, you can ask, are we talking about the things that really matter to me in life? Like the things that really are pushing my boundaries and pissing me off so much that I feel compelled to write something on social media.
This is Wisconsin. We might buy that cheese ball. I want to make that clear, Todd. We're talking to Todd Kashtan, professor of psychology at George Mason University in Northern Virginia. We are talking about friendships, putting more value on them, auditing them, seeing if they're doing what we want in our lives, and maybe, if that's what it takes, ending them. You could join in with your friendship stories, good, bad, otherwise, at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Let's bring on a caller now. Chloe is with us in La Crosse. Chloe, hi.
Hi, how's it going?
Good. What'd you want to tell us about?
I just wanted to say, I think it's really cool that you guys are doing this segment. And I've had friends that I've kept since second grade, and it's been some of the most valuable time for me in my life. And those friends that I've had the longest, I also have a ton of conflict with, because I'm a person who doesn't shy away from conflict. And we've had breakups, and a lot of times we've come back together and our relationship's been even stronger. And I think it's the same as a romantic relationship. You have to stick up for what's right for you. And sometimes you push someone away for a bit, but with those friendships, sometimes they get stronger because of it.
Interesting, Chloe. Thanks so much for sharing that. Well, Todd, let's talk about that. When is it time to think about a friendship breakup, or in Chloe's case, a friendship break for a while?
Yeah, I just want to say, I'm so glad Chloe was the first call, because she's such a role model for thinking about friendship seriously, which is that you can break up and you can get back together again. And part of this is, and here's like a mantra that I tend to have as a psychologist, which is, other than your old friends, like Chloe's talking about having those people that have known her at different stages of her life since second grade, if you have no change in your friendships every 10 years, you can ask yourself, am I even growing or evolving a lot? Like, you should be outgrowing a few of your friendships. And one of the things is to have sometimes those difficult conversations with yourself first is, do I feel as if I am being the person I most like to be when I'm around these characters?
Chloe, thanks a lot for that call at 800-642-1234. Now, Todd, one option is, you know, sometimes friendships just slowly fizzle and nobody really notices it and then they're just gone. But you give examples in your own life and that of others where there's a conversation about the end of a friendship. That sounds horrible to me. How, if we're in that situation where we want to talk about dissolving the friendship, how do we have that conversation?
Yeah, I'm glad you felt the, you know, that clamminess inside, because you should feel that. And if you don't, it probably the relationship doesn't mean anything. I mean, one of the most important strategies is what I call the discomfort caveat. And this is also useful if you want to get a raise at work and have that conversation with your boss, which is, start the conversation by describing how hard the conversation is for you and why. And so you might want to go to someone and say, listen, I love hanging out with you. We've been friends ever since our kids started playing with each other in kindergarten. But sometimes, and I feel even anxious saying this to you, I feel as if I am such a low priority in your life that you would, if the ice cream man came down the block, you would cancel plans that we set for months to go see a concert to make sure that you were in line with your kids to go get some cones. And it feels as if it's so unimportant to you and I feel differently. Like, maybe we should just kind of have a conversation about that. And by you revealing that you feel anxious about it up front, what that does is it brings people's defenses down and they feel compassion and empathy as opposed to trying to rip your head off.
And you've been through conversations like this. You wrote about some of them. I mean, how bad was it? I get clabby just thinking about it. How did it come out?
Yeah, they're cringy, you know, but they make great stories. And I'm really proud of myself that I actually did it, because you really, you know, you just want to like just take your head into another whiskey and say, I'll just wait until this thing, they fade out and stop calling me. You know, one of the scenarios that I talk about is when I was in my 30s and I had a friend who was super intelligent, like entrepreneur. And every time he hung out, he would tell me about his new ventures, how much money he's making. I mean, would list the actual details of all the amazing things that he bought. And I was just barely surviving paycheck to paycheck to pay for my townhouse. And I realized after several months that he never asked me any questions ever. And while I enjoy hearing about and I love his successes, it's really important is it reciprocated? And all of us have this experience of, hey, did that person ask you any questions over that 3-hour dinner? And you're always like, no. So we must be that person sometimes to other people. And I think if we are just candid enough to say, hey, I just want to say, I know this is uncomfortable to say, I realize you didn't ask me one thing over that entire 3-hour time we're having a barbecue. And we're standing right next to each other. Like, did you even notice that? And they'll probably say no. And they'll probably appreciate the feedback, even though you might get some shock and awe in the beginning.
We're talking about friendships with Todd Kashdan, professor of psychology at George Mason University. Talk about how to evaluate, to mend, and if necessary, end those relationships. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you have an experience you'd like to share, a question for our guest, have you ever consciously and actively decided to end a friendship with someone, or flip it around? Did you ever find an old friendship that you realized had fizzled and rekindled it? You reached out and sparked it all over again. Join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll continue the conversation coming up here on Central Time. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. We're picking up the conversation with social relationships expert Todd Kashdan, professor of psychology at George Mason University, talking about the state of friendships around the country and maybe your own friendships and how and when to decide to end them if need be. You could join in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Edward called us from Illinois. Couldn't stay on the line, but Edward says he had friends he made related to substance abuse. But when lives change in that regard, he says it's hard to remain connected. Todd, a situation where maintaining those connections, as much as you may have appreciated at the time, may endanger your recovery. This is a pretty important thing to think about.
Yeah, and I'm again another role model, which is, to what degree am I in a relationship with someone that's improving my mental health or leading to a deterioration in my mental health? And this happens a lot with men as well, where often when you're first dating and you're younger and you're in your 20s and you're taking more risks, is you develop these friendships where you gain social status and likability by how many boundaries you break. And when you get older and you have a more stable life and maybe you found a person, maybe you formed a family, those relationships often become, for lack of a better word, too immature for our current value system. And that's often a very challenging divide, because you like the 20-something person you are when you're around them, but you know that's not really who you are at the present time. And we have to honor that as we change, we might need to change our relationships. And sometimes it just means spending less time with those people that we knew in our younger years.
Let's go back to our callers at 800-642-1234. Pam is with us now in Marshall. Pam, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to tell us about?
I just wanted to talk. Well, I had a friend many years ago. I'm 73, and this was when I was about 30. And she wanted me to help her. She had some money she needed to be borrowed to, and I didn't have a lot, but whatever, I helped her. And then she wanted me to babysit free for at night, so she could go out, and I was working full-time and a single parent also, but I did. Problem was, in those days, I didn't know how to say no until I got to the point that I got furious. So I finally got furious and told her I wasn't going to have her in my life again. And then about 20 years ago, and I had moved and everything, somehow she got a hold of me by phone, left me a message to please call her. She really, really wanted to talk. She couldn't wait to hear me again. I called her, and she wanted to know if she could borrow $20. Oh. I broke up with her again.
Pam, wow. I'm sorry about that, but thanks for sharing that. Todd, yeah, we want to help our friends. We want to be there for them. Where do we cross the line into, as our caller was, of being taken advantage of?
You know, it's funny. I have three daughters, and two are twin 16-year-olds, and I regularly tell them when they talk about problems with their friends or anyone they're dating, of like, hey, what's the ratio of stress to joy? And when the ratio is really problematic, really high numbers, where really stressful, like I don't even, like I'm doing favors, but I don't even feel good about them, like Pam is describing. And like, where's the joy that counteracting that? If you can't get those numbers to balance out, like it does, the math does the work for you, and you realize, do I have other people that can replace them that could increase the quality of my life?
Thanks again for sharing that story. We heard from Allie in Appleton, who couldn't stay on, but has a question about how to maintain friendship if you have a friend who keeps emotionally dumping problems onto you. So this is kind of related, I feel like, Todd. Like, if it's always a one-way street and they can dump their problems on you and you can go, when you're having trouble, talk it to them, that's one thing. If it's a one-way street, maybe something different.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a psychologist. I try to pretend I'm not one when I'm on airplanes and when I'm traveling, just because of this reason. Because as soon as I say it, I hear about everyone's divorces and all that, how horrible their kids are. I usually say, like, I'm an etymologist, or I'm a book editor. One of the important things for men in particular, because they're worse at this than women, is to signal the alarm and test it before a fire starts. And that is, low stakes, difficult experiences, throw them out there and see if your friends will ask questions, ask for details, take curiosity in what you're going to say. Because that tells you, before the big stuff happens, like, do they care and are they invested in my well-being? And if it's okay for asymmetry to happen here and there where people are unloading on you every once in a while, it's never going to be equal in the moment, mm-hmm. but span the timeline over months and years. But you have to give a little bit of self-blame if you're not disclosing important things yourself that are difficult.
Talking to Todd Kashdan from George Mason University. Even though he tries to hide it, he is a psychologist and he writes about social relationships online very frequently. Still time for your experiences at 800-642-1234. Todd, I see every now and then there'll be a wave of articles on, you know, adults maybe don't have enough friends these days and adults don't know how to make friends because it's not like we're five and we can walk up to somebody and say, will you be my friend? Or I don't know, can we?
Yeah.
How do we build new friendships?
You know, there's a great series of studies from the University of Chicago, and they ask people before they go on to public trains, metros, what do you think it'll be like for the person, a stranger, if you went up and had a conversation with them? And they say, oh my God, it'd be terrible. I'd be in their personal space. They'd probably spit on me. Like, they'd probably like videotape me and start cursing me out. And then they ask people to actually do it. Go talk to a stranger. Like, ask them about, like, what they're wearing. Like, what's the article that they're reading? And what you find is people underestimate how enjoyable it is for someone to come up to them and talk to them who's a stranger. And people underestimate how pleasurable it is to have a conversation with a stranger. So everyone is making an erroneous expectation of what it's like to talk to someone. And because of that, you have all these people, more often men than women, that are sitting right next to each other and don't say a word because everyone thinks the other person would be particularly uncomfortable if a conversation was to be triggered.
Now, here's another question. You know, we've been talking about how we can evaluate if, you know, we have a bad friendship or the other person has turned into a bad friend. How can we self-diagnose and ask the question, am I the bad friend? Like, I know how I'm a bad friend. I'm terrible if we live in different cities. I'm terrible about keeping up with people. I know this. I've taken some steps on that. How do we self-evaluate to make sure we're being good friends to our friends?
Yeah, it's a really good question. I mean, obviously the easier answer is you could ask someone, but you're not going to really get probably an honest response. When I ask people for their evaluation of me as a friend, as a colleague, I always open with a caveat of like, listen, I want you to start with the negative things. There's something that I have to suck at. Like, I am not the master of being a friend. So start with that. Tell me what I could do better. And then from there, you're not talking about, am I a good friend or not? They're just giving you, like, very playfully, you're having a jovial conversation of, what are you an 8 at or a 7 at, as opposed to a 10? And what they bring up, it's going to be like, you know, it's like the secret sauce of how bad it really is. Like, are they bringing up something that's minuscule? Like, you know, when I go on the grill, you never come and talk to me. You just run around the party as if, like, I don't even exist. Or are they saying, you know what? I kind of feel like you're almost flirting with my wife all the time. So those are two very different responses.
How do we, just very briefly, Todd, I would be worried about, I would instantly lapse into defensive mode no matter how much I brace myself. How do we turn down those shields a little bit?
Yeah, so I think the answer is roll with the waves that happen there. So you are going to be defensive. You might be upset and say, whoa, that's a lot coming at me. I can't believe you waited this long to tell me. All right, I'm going to grab a drink. I'm going to come right back and just like, let's just like put a cap and actually have this conversation now. And I will try my best not to blow my lid. So bringing like a little bit of playfulness into a serious conversation, just to like allow it to take place. And then a few days later, you could have the more important detailed, nuanced conversation about what actually happened there and what you, now that you can think about it, what you really want to say.
Todd, we'll leave it there. Thanks for joining us again.
My pleasure.
That's Todd Kashdan, professor of psychology at George Mason University. We talked to him about evaluating our friendships, some of the best ways to fix them or end them if and when they've run their course for one reason or another. Keep sharing your stories over on the Ideas Network Facebook page. I'm Rob Ferret. This is Central Time.